of a hybrid, actually, between an environmental engineer. I did my postdoc as an environmental engineer at UCF before I got my job in the chemistry department. I got my PhD, though, in chemistry, obviously. And what I want to talk about today, and I'm going to go over some of the things that we're doing in my lab, some of the directions that we're taking, tell you about some of these compounds, why they're a problem, why they're so hard to remediate out in the environment, and how we're kind of approaching it to move into that. And let me tell you about this real quick. I love this, by the way, not having a laser pointer. Normally I would have a yardstick, because a yardstick is easier to beat off the screen with it, and if anybody starts to fall asleep, it has a second purpose to it. But this is taken, this picture is taken off of my backyard. I live out on the St. John's River. And one day I was looking across the river and I see all these rosettes, spoonbill rosettes over there. And while they're sitting there, minding their own business on the edge of the river on the opposite side, this little alligator comes by. I did not crop that in there. This is an actual picture of across the river, across from my house. I show that to my students and let them figure out whether they're the birds or the alligator and where I fit in there. Okay, so an overview of what I'm going to talk about here is, what are persistent organic pollutants? Where do we come in contact with these? What are the challenges in cleaning them up in the environment? There's a reason that these things just stay out there and we can't handle or can't come up with ways to deal with them very easily. So new options, and that's what's going on in my lab, new options of how to clean these things up. And then maybe a little discussion, you know, at the end with you all on what do you think the future for robotic environmental remediation is in the current climate and what's going on. That's really of great importance. First of all, a persistent organic pollutant, they're organic compounds. There are inorganic compounds as well. But persistent organic pollutants, for me, they're resistant to environmental degradation through chemical, biological, or photolytic processes. And because of this, they're going to be persistent in the environment. Another bad thing about it is they're capable of long-range transport. There's a lot of study into how pollutants move through around the Earth. They're initiated in these mid-regions of the Earth, but yet they find them in seals up in the Arctic and in waters up in the Arctic. So these things have a way of getting back up into the atmosphere, kind of grasshoppering up latitudinally up across the globe. They bioaccumulate in tissue, biomagnify in food chains as things eat them going up the line in the food chain, and so they have potential significant impacts on human health and the environment. A key part of this is when these things, when these chemicals were first being used, or definitely when they were first synthesized and we were figuring out how to use them, it wasn't known. They didn't know that these things would stick around. Well, they may have known they would stick around a long time, but they didn't know how they would interact biologically with people and things. I would not be a good chemist if I did not bring a slide like this, right? Okay, the first one up over here is DDT. And take a look at these in groups here. Tropocene, dielgren, chlordane, and aldrin, and how similar those structures are. And notice also that they're loaded with chlorine. All of those pesticides are loaded with chlorine. These all have very long half-lives and they stick around a long time in the environment. That's part of what makes them such a problem, is that they don't go away very easily. Some of them I've likened to being like super molecules, which brings me over here to PCBs. Been doing work with PCBs for the past 9 years in working on degradation methodologies for that with Congress and Goodwin. PBDs, we worked on that in the lab also. These are flame retardants. Flame retardants. Peel off used as flame retardants in some countries, including our own DECA bromidated PBDs is still used industrially. And PCBD, California Garbento dioxin, which is a really bad player. If you can detect it, it's over the limit. All right, this is a really common stuff particularly with the one construct, it has a terraforming over here and a terraforming coming off over here. Some of the rest of them have not been found to be toxic. However, if they degrade down to that tetracongener, it becomes a very toxic substance. And finally, the last class that I'd like to mention is over here, benzoate pyrene. We're also working with that with one of my PhD students, and we've had some luck with degrading that. The reason that's important is what we all saw this past summer going on out in the Gulf. Those kinds of releases end up producing compounds like benzoate pyrene. Benzoate pyrene is the really toxic PAH, polyaromatic hydrocarbon, that is found out in the environment. It comes from a myriad of degradation processes or combustion processes, but also in things like crude oil. After other things go away, this tends to stick around and be a real problem. A big question here. Why were these things ever used? Number one, they just didn't know. I'm looking around here, half of you are, at least half of you are younger than I am, and then there's a few of you, Ed, who are older than I am. When I was a kid, growing up in Florida, and you know that mosquito fog truck? We used to ride our bicycles behind this thing. You know, we thought this was really cool. And nobody really realized that that chemical might be harmful to us. We just didn't think about it. They were spraying it out into the air. You know, it's going everywhere. It can't be that harmful to it. We just didn't have a grasp on it. We used to break mercury thermometers and play with the mercury and have all kinds of fun with that as well. So it was the awareness of what chemicals could do to you. It was not really sharp for us in society at large. We weren't really in tune to that. We're much more chemically aware now than we were 4 decades ago. So, with that being said, a lot of these things that are getting out into the environment, it wasn't bad people that put them out there. They truly didn't know that it was harmful. And they truly didn't know that they would not degrade like they do. And I'll show you an example of that. This second bullet right here is really important. These chemicals have really great properties. There's a reason PCBs are used in all kinds of things. A lot of my research right now is focused on PCBs in coffin material. Maybe you've read about that. From schools up in the Northeast, in particular New York and the Boston area.
Coffee.
Caulking.
Oh.
Caulking. No. Drink that caulking. But caulking material. Everybody know what caulking is?
Yeah.
There's stuff you pour in between the walls and corners and such. Well, PCBs aided in keeping the plasticity of that caulking so that it would stay, friable for long periods of time. And by golly, it does. And because we have some of this caulking material from actually now over in Europe as well, and it has up to 25% by mass of PCBs in it. 25% of the mass of this caulking is PCBs. But it's still pliable. 40 years later, this caulking is still pliable. The PCBs made it do what it was supposed to do. The sidebar to that is the PCBs don't degrade very easily at all. They're like a super molecule. There is some biodegrading organisms, but they're really specific to certain PCB congeners and only in certain areas, whether it's in air or anoxic. At one time, we wanted our chemicals to have a long half-life, and we were very successful in making chemicals with long half-life. And it was in the 70s that these chemicals started coming under regulatory statutes and being pulled off the market. Some of them, we didn't even know they were harmful, but we knew these things stick around too long. We're detecting them in the water. We don't know what they do. So since they stick around so long, we better pull them off. Fluoridane was one of them. Fluoridane for those of you who don't already know, was a super chemical for killing termites. It really controlled termites. But we had to take it off the market partially due to overuse because people did not have an appreciation for the properties of the chemical. It was overused, so then it started getting washed off. And finally, more people, more of the big fight, more pollution. More of the things that we're using, the more of them are going to go out into the environment, the more people there are, the more we want to have a high lifestyle, we're going to be using these type of substances in our life and throwing them away. So another persistent problem, besides all these pesticides that I just showed you, flame retardants and PAHs, is groundwater contamination, and particularly important in Florida because we are so dependent upon groundwater here, as opposed to many other states where they use a lot of surface water as well. Contaminating our aquifers is a really big thing here. Florida is so dependent upon water. I like to ask this question. How many of you are Floridians by birth? Okay, so if you've grown up in the state, hopefully while you were growing up, you saw enough of the natural state to understand that this place is super dependent upon water. If our water dried up, it looks like the whole place would just collapse down a couple feet, doesn't it? Everything here is so dependent upon moisture to keep green. The rivers, the swamps. All of that is very necessary. At one point, we thought that those swamps were important. Now we know they are. Okay, so a little primer here on groundwater and how it can get contaminated so easily. And what you're seeing here in this diagram is an isotonic aquifer where it does not have an impermeable surface above it, but it does have one below it. And then you have a confined aquifer that has both an impermeable surface above and below it. Now we can think of that Florida aquifer, big aquifer, as being something like this. Sometimes it's shallow. The Florida aquifer in some places, you know, it's got springs that come right up to the surface. Other places, it's a couple thousand feet deep. But the Florida aquifer is protected in most places by both limestone above it, or tarsh type structure above it, and below it. We have these unconfined aquifers. If you go out with a shovel during the rainy season and dig in your yard, how many shovelfuls of dirt are you going to get out of there before you see standing water in the hole? Once you get down to that point, you're in an aquifer. You're into the groundwater at that point. So that saturated area down there is called an aquifer. An aquifer does not have to be a limestone cave formation. An aquifer can be water flowing through dirt under the surface. That's a shallow aquifer. Absolutely. When you sink a well and you're pulling up shallow well for your sprinkler system, that's what you're usually getting into. So, with that, and seeing this tunnelway like this, you can see with infiltration as well, how you can get contamination down into these areas like this. So, if you pour something on the surface and then water comes along, and it's pushing it down into the subsurface, it's headed for an aquifer if it's denser than water. All right, so I'm going to show you just a few little slides here to show you how you can get contamination into an aquifer. And what I'm talking about here is a dense non-aqueous phase liquid. That's called a DNAPL in the business. And a lot of organic, chlorinated organic compounds qualify as DNAPL. When they hit water, if I have water, container of water, and I add DNAPL to it, the DNAPL will sink because it's denser than water. It doesn't float on top, it sinks. And that's key in how we treat these things. Because if it floated on water, it would be easier to find. But because it sinks down into the aquifer, it makes it very hard to find. It makes the contamination really get widespread. Okay, so there it is. Somebody kicked over a barrel of TCE, and it's sitting out on the ground surface out there. That's the yellow stuff with the arrow pointing to it. Over time, rainfall, etc., it's starting to seep down into the subsurface. Now, this subsurface, remember, is just dirt. Dirt, rock, clay, various things like that. So as water keeps percolating down into that, it starts pushing the stuff along with it. And it's not following a single column. There's no reason to believe that it would, right? Because the soil is very heterogeneous. This stuff is going to follow the path of least resistance. So it's going to spread not like this, but like this. And then once it gets down into a water area, if it has tidal influence, it's going to get smeared back and forth from the tidal influence as it goes down as well. So let me go to the next slide. And over time, look at how it's spreading out. Therein lies the issue with this stuff. Because it spreads out like this, what it's showing you is it's putting some kind of impermeable surface here. Impermeable surface, they cannot stay for the thing through. Say a really dense clay layer. And it starts going around the top of that, but still smearing through all the surface. Trichloroethylene, the regulatory limits on it are 5 parts per billion. So 1 cup of it will contaminate 12 million gallons of water. 1 cup of this stuff, beyond where you should be drinking it. It's a carcinogen. Some of this breakdown product can be worse carcinogen than it is. So it's really a bad player. 70% of Superfund sites in the United States had this going on. And this is what was making Superfund sites. And then finally, that those lines there indicate like a municipal drinking water well. It gets up into the well, got to close off the well, got to find water someplace else because you can't use it any longer. Well, there were different techniques for treating this kind of contaminant. Excavation, if you can catch it shallow enough and know where it is, you can dig it out. Pump and treat, where they just put down wells and they keep pumping the water out. They pass the contaminated water through like a carbon canister. The carbon stores up the TCE and then they take that clean water and inject it back on in. But you never really get it all out that way because this stuff is binding up to the organic matter in the soil. You can't really pump it out. You'll think you've got it pumped out, but it'll drop down to the level. As soon as you stop pumping, it starts desorbing back into the water some more. You take another sample and come back up really high. So this is pump and treat is kind of a band-aid for it, but it's not really a way to remediate it. There's a few other ways that I've been involved with out in field tests like bioremediation or bioaugmentation. And there is a particular strain of microbe called the Halopropoides that is very effective at dechlorinating this. It is an anaerobic microbe, so it cannot exist up where there's air. It's got to be used very carefully, and people that know what they're doing have to be the ones that use it to be able to get it down into the ground and have it sustain. It is it's native in a lot of places. So they can do soil tests and find out that Halopropoides exists there anyway. But not all the Halopropoides are the same. Only about 1/4 of them have the genetic makeup to make them dechlorinate this stuff. Not all of them do. So they don't make them all the same, evidently. And I was up, I spent some time up in Canada at an engineering firm that raises, I'm not a biochemist, I'm not a bio person, so this, for lack of a better word, they're raising microbes up there and producing this stuff. And for one canister about this big around and about this high, it was $10,000. Yeah, good business, the end, right? And they send many of those canisters when they go to their site.
How much of the
I don't know. I don't have an answer for you with that. And they do different things with it. Like I've got up there bioremediation, bioaugmentation. Sometimes what you have, if you have a native population of it, what I've seen them do is they will feed that native population with things like ethanol, and they have something called meal, M-E-A-L, that they inject down into the subsurface to really get these things multiplying and build up the population that's already there. And then they'll cut off the food source for it, and then it will start eating all this chlorinated stuff when we have this high population of it. So there's different avenues that they go about with it. And I'm not sure what they would do with it when they get it out there, whether they take one canister, get it down there, feed it, and try to get that population growing, or they just try to inject enough from the very get-go. Okay, what I've got down here at the bottom is that it can be potassium permanganate is something called chemox. This is one of the chemox chemicals that they use to oxidize trichloroethylene as well. It takes it to CO2. And that works fairly well too. So what they've seen with this is that they can use it as a polishing technique, just like they use the chemox technique. So after you can treat it some other way to get rid of most of the mass, then you use the bioaugmentation to really wipe out the end amount of it. Zero valent iron, first of all, just means iron metal. It's not iron oxide, theoretically. It's not iron chloride. It's not iron sulfate. It's just iron metal. And it was found by accident up at a university in Waterloo, Canada, that iron will dechlorinate these compounds under the right conditions. Iron's pretty cheap. Iron's not considered something that's toxic to us. And this whole process does not create any new toxic substances in the environment. So iron was a good candidate for trying to get iron down into these areas to degrade these denatural compounds. Now, one of the issues with it, though, is that we say iron is hydrophilic, meaning that any solid surface, you have a layer at that solid surface where ions are coming off of it. So I have iron 2 coming off of my iron metal at any one time. And that iron 2 is definitely going to be more attracted to water than it's attracted to organics. So that's why I'm calling it hydrophilic. And what we found in some experiments in the lab is actually if I take some trichloroethylene and sprinkle some nano iron, nanoscale size iron on the top of it, it floats. It doesn't even go down into the trichloroethylene. And if you can't get it down into it, it gets a reagent down there to clean it up and it's good. So we wanted to come up with a technology where we could get everything down in there and challenge this DNAPL. So we came up with an emulsion technology where we actually incorporate the iron as well as water into a hydrophobic membrane. Hydrophobic being the same as the TPE is. TPE is hydrophobic. And then we could inject that down into the subsurface, and that would challenge the TPE, pull it up into these little droplets, which act as microreactors down the subsurface, and degrade it. And it did a really good job of it. Every now and then, you know, you hit something and it works, and this is one of them. Let me see if I got a picture here. So here's a picture of what one of these droplets looks like. It's just a diagram at the top telling you what's in it. So the outer layer is oil, vegetable oil, corn oil, soy oil, various kinds of oils that we use for this. A little bit of food grade surfactant. And then on the interior of it, you have water. On the inside right in here, you have water, and then these are small iron particles. The smaller they are, the easier it is to pump this stuff through the soil. So we use nanoscale iron in this. We've also used microscale iron in this. And it's worked very effectively. And this droplet you see here, flattened out with a cover slip, is 12 microns across. So when you just look at these droplets under the microscope, what you see are 1 micron up to about 10 micron size of these droplets. So they're very, very tiny droplets. And this is that experiment where I was telling you about iron and what iron does to DNAPL. What we have over here is add iron to it, see what the iron does with it. Well, this is what the iron does with it. The iron is just on top of it. And what I didn't sit on very, what I didn't show you very long back there was that this reaction needs water to happen. It needs hydrogen ions, and the hydrogen ions come from water. So if the iron is just in direct contact with pure TCE, it isn't going to do anything unless it can carry some water down there with it. And then this is the same thing we have over here on the left, and we add a little more emulsion to it. And you can see the emulsion becomes one with it as it goes right down into it, and it takes that water and the iron down into it. So that was the key to making this work. We were taking all our reagents with us down into it. This has worked really great. This is, we patented this actually back in 2002, and our first demonstration was in 2002. We demonstrated it to the EPA a couple times since then. It has since won lots of awards, and I invented it. I'm on the patent, but I get no money. it's been used in over 20 states at many, many different sites in 20 states. It's cleaned dozens of sites below regulatory levels. It's been used in 4 different countries now successfully. So this was a good success story, and it was a good success story for technology transfer for university professors to be involved in something and end up getting it out into the field is miraculous. That's not what I'm good at. I'm good at creating this stuff, not marketing it. Maybe I'm wrong about marketing it. Maybe I'm better at marketing. I don't know. I like the lab better. Maybe that's it. All right, now moving over from groundwater contamination and looking at something different, those PCBs that I mentioned earlier. We started working with PCBs back early in the last decade, and what a challenge PCBs have been. At the time, of course, we were said, well, maybe let's try iron with it. Iron does not work very well with PCBs. We needed a metal that's stronger than that. It has a higher potential. So looked at magnesium as one of the metals. And magnesium actually works pretty well with degrading PCBs under the right conditions. And initially, we coated this magnesium with a plate. And that worked really well. We had to have it under the right conditions. The only drawback to it, we had success, we took that out in a field trial after we learned enough about it. I never had it explode on me. However, one of my colleagues, who was not following protocol when we were doing a field test, had a kilogram of it go up on him. And we had to get him to the hospital. He looked like Mickey Mouse for a while because his hands were wrapped with gauze for many weeks for the burns he got on his hand. And a lot of kids are actually drawn into chemistry because of explosions. that wasn't what drew me into chemistry, I have to tell you. But it gave me a new respect for the power and the energy that a small mass can contain. Because what happens with this palladium? Palladium is a common kind of oxidation catalyst. I can pour Niagara Falls on this magnesium palladium system, and it's a cloud. But if I have this stuff sitting out where water vapor is, I'm in big trouble because it's going to go. What happens is it pulls the hydrogen, or let me rephrase that. The magnesium is producing hydrogen gas from reaction with the water. The hydrogen gas goes and sits on the palladium surface. The palladium takes that hydrogen gas, which is H2, and separates it into hydrogen atoms. What do you think hydrogen atoms do with oxygen from the atmosphere? Makes water. Very, very energetically makes water. And that's what happened that day. I mean, we just, you know, we weren't following protocol. He wasn't following protocol because I was in the process of going, no, when it blew, and then it blew 6 feet away. 6 feet away. And he's 250 pounds at least. It threw him back 5 feet at least. And melted the gloves onto his hands. So, this was not something we wanted to continue working with, and you'll be happy to know we found other avenues to work with after a time. But, one of the things we quit doing was working directly in water. What we were looking at trying to remediate was tape on walls. Because remember, I told you that PCBs, they put PCBs into everything? Well, they used to put PCBs into paint on walls. Because it made the paint stick better, it made the paint last longer, and if it was at a facility where they were putting heat onto it, the paint would stay. One of the places we worked with this was at launch complexes at NASA. We also went up to another NASA facility where they have these things called flame buckets, where they would test the engines out in these really, really tall constructions. And so the engine would blow a flame down, and this thing was shaped like that. So the flame would come down and go out this way and blow the flame out and disperse the energy of it. But those flame buckets had to be painted with stuff that can endure the heat. So a lot of PCBs used in that. A lot of PCBs used in a lot of paints back from 1970s until the war. So the trick was, how do you get the PCBs out of the paint? So we developed a paste material that would open up the paint structure and draw the PCBs out of the paint structure into our paste. And then within our paste, we would have our bimetal particles. And once you get the PCBs into that paste, it would come in contact with those bimetal particles and degrade from polychlorinated biphenyl down to biphenyl, which is relatively harmful in comparison to PCBs. Take it off of a TSCA level risk management. So we had to extract the PCBs from the coatings and then degrade the PCBs once it got into our paste material. What we have switched to from the MGPT is just using zero-valent magnesium with a little bit of acid in the system, and miraculously it works. Guess how much palladium costs per ounce? How much? Last time I checked, it was $867 an ounce. So it was very beneficial, speaking of marketing, it was very beneficial to eliminate the palladium from this mix. Okay, you guys really probably aren't too interested in the paste formulation, but let me just point out that every one of these things in here is considered a green chemical, meaning it's not toxic to people, it's not a problem to be using it out in the environment. One of our challenges in doing the work I do is EPA isn't going to let me use anything I come up with if I'm putting something toxic out into the environment. So if I come and tell them I got the best thing in the world to degrade PCBs, but oh, by the way, your people are going to have to wear, you know, masks and complete suits while they're putting it on, and oh, we can't leave any behind because then that would be a toxic material if we left any of it behind, EPA will just say, no, go back to your lab, woman, and come up with something better. We put a sealant over top of it to keep it from drying out so that we can keep the active ingredients moving in it. We tested this out at a vertical integration building at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, and they had PCB concentrations up to 100 milligrams per kilogram of paint. And that's a picture of the building. Since then, this building has actually been torn down. And this just shows some of our workers out there actually applying this. We formulated it so that you could put it in a paint sprayer and spray it on, and then you could come back with another paint sprayer with a sealant sealed over top of it. You leave it there for a few weeks, come back, cut the sealant off, scrape it off. And it will not probably have degraded all the PCBs, but it will pull the PCBs out by then. So it'll get it into the paste material. That's because it's a, they're, number one, they're spraying it, so they're putting it out in, you know, in aerosolized form, and we're testing it. So, yeah, I don't test things out on my students. They are cheap labor, you know, so I want to be good to them. Okay, now what this is showing you here from that first demonstration, I've got to get some graphs up here because it's what I do, make graphs. Is that within the 2 weeks, we were up to 80% removal, and 3 weeks, we moved up closer to 100% removal of PCBs out of that paint.
Did you need to look at it again?
Yeah, what's the difference between the active and the non-active?
The non-active doesn't have any metal in it. So what we do is we just put the paste, we make the paste, it sucks the PCBs out, we collect the paste, put it in a drum, and then add the metal into the drum, stir it in with a little more solvent, and cap the drum, which is actually, I think, this is a sidebar, but I think that's the way that they ought to go in industry and using it.
How does the paste do that?
The paste opens up the lattice of the paint. You can think of the paint being a lattice structure. Opens up that lattice of the paste, and the PCBs are attracted to that organic in the paste, and it draws the PCBs out of it. The paint is not usable afterwards. I'm not suggesting that you wouldn't have to repaint afterwards, but it softens it just like the paint softens it. These are from different samples and taking it off of different spots. And another thing that I should, before I ever show graphs of my work, field samples are inherently heterogeneous, paint in particular, because nobody was thinking about us coming by and doing studies on this later. So here could be 5 layers of paint, there could be 3 layers of paint. And in some places there is 3 layers, and in some places there's 5 layers. So, and in some places, certain paints were used as a primer, and certain ones weren't used as a primer, and another spot on it. So you don't really know where it is. You have to take a whole lot of samples to be able to get the norm on it. That would probably be from 2 samples averaged there.
Yeah.
Not always, not just after 3 weeks. A lot of, sometimes it would drop it down very, very low, but it depends on the starting concentration of it. Sometimes you have to add more metal, or you have to add, specifically in the case of the magnesium with no palladium on it, you have to add some more acid and ethanol to get the magnesium going again. Because the magnesium will start losing some of its efficiency at the surface. That's exactly what's going on in most cases. If it's lower, if it's 100 parts per million, like this is 100 ppm at the beginning, it's not so terribly high for our work. And that can get it down. But when you're starting in thousands, many thousands, which I'll show you one in a moment, where it was 55,000 parts per million in the paint at the beginning, A, you can't get all of it out, and B, you're going to get so much into the paste you can't degrade it. You've probably overloaded the capacity of the metal to degrade it at that point. Field demonstration 2. I love field demonstrations, by the way. I just love field demonstrations because I get to go out and actually see where this stuff is being used. A lot of times I'm out on military bases when I'm doing this, and that's a lot of fun too. I was up in Parris Island for one demonstration, and you remember Gomer Pyle? Those sergeants do to those people what the sergeants did in Gomer Pyle. That's actually what was happening at Parris Island, the Marine base up in South Carolina. So I learned all kinds of sidebar things when I'm up there watching this. It was they get right up in their face and they scream at them a lot and bouncing around next to them. And
and we're over there doing wells and mixing kind of stuff and putting it in. So this was at Badger Munitions Depot in Wisconsin. And we went there, it was snowing. It was in April, but it was still snowing in Badger, Wisconsin. Some of these structures range in concentration from low 30 up to 55,000 parts per million in the paint to remediate. Some of them we did outside, so it was exposed to the environment, and it was snowing when we put it on and sealed it, and it still worked. Some of them, the really high concentrations, did not work so well. I shouldn't say it that way. They still took out like 2/3 of the PCBs, but you couldn't get it down in one application all the way down. It gets saturated with it, and it's an equilibrium process that's going on. So once you get, take it all off the right, and you'll keep dropping it down. And these are just some pictures of the areas in the site where we work. This is a very interesting site in that they used to make ammunition. So they had things like called a nitrating house, where they had these huge tanks where they used to make nitrocellulose and nitroglycerin in there. And it's just fascinating learning the history of these places. This was called a press house. And my best understanding is that they pressed this stuff into pellets before, and that's why it's these big concrete facilities, because they can grow up. That's a very good question. And those people thought I was just being a real wimp when I asked them about the temperature, because of Floridian and I'm going up there to the freezing weather. And it wasn't it at all. It's just like if you try to dissolve sugar into hot water versus dissolving sugar into cold water, it's going to go at a different rate. And we found that it in fact does go a little slower. A lot of reactions go slower when it's colder. So it goes a little bit slower, but it still works. We actually tested this sub-zero in the laboratory, and it still works, but it will work a little bit slower. And that's just more about the press house and where we sampled and what we did. The results were very good. The concentrations in those bunkers, those press houses, were 1,800 milligrams per kilogram, up to almost 4,000, and we got significant reduction after a week, and post-treatment from 96 up to 200 parts per million in it. And we've shown in laboratory studies that a second application can get it down below 50. And that's just another graph showing the data and how it drops off dramatically in a week. And that's another area where we worked on, and you can see from the graph again, it drops off dramatically within that first week. That was the nitrating facility, where we had up to 50,000 or 53,000 milligrams per kilogram. Post-treatment concentrations were between 6,600 and 20,000 milligrams per kilogram. So it would need a second application in order to do this. Okay, the non-active paste, we saw the same thing as far as drawing it out of the paint. It was very, very effective at drawing it out of the paint. In some of our tests, though, we saw the active paste seemed to be drawing it out more. And I think the process is that as you're drawing it out, if you're degrading it, then you're helping your equilibrium and continuing to draw it out of the paste, out of the paint into the paste. Now, this is the important part right now. Paint, you know, I was just over in Denmark last month for an application of this type of material in Denmark, in Copenhagen. But the real bugaboo is the concrete. And that's where they're having the big problems up in New York. Remember I mentioned that up in buildings, public buildings up in the state of New York as well as Massachusetts, they have PCBs that have gotten not just into the paint, but it's gone beyond the paint, into the concrete structures, into wood. And how do they treat that? How do you treat that? Well, we found in our first field test that we were drawing it out of the concrete. So this is a big deal. We've done a lot of work since we did this field test, and we've had some really good results. We've got some samples
from an unnamed university in Boston area, who sent us some samples from some very, very old structures, so you might get some guesses about this unnamed university in the Boston area. And we've been able to draw PCBs out of granite, out of brick, out of dense concrete. Where we have trouble with it is very porous concrete structures, like, you know, a cinder block, like you would buy from Home Depot. That's a very porous concrete structure. And what we're finding with that is we draw a lot out, but we're also taking some down into the concrete from the surface. So, you know, we haven't figured out everything on this yet. But this is also now a patented process, and there are, I think, three companies who have licensed it. We patented through NASA, and there are three companies who have licensed it, one of them being in Denmark. So we have a European license going on with it as well. And that's kind of exciting. The other things I wanted to point out to you guys, one of those pesticides that I showed you at the very beginning, one of our colleagues that we work with from an engineering firm in Canada has a client who has dieldrin, fluoridane, heptachlor, and I can't think of the other pesticide, in a very large area contaminated in soil. And what we found in laboratory tests so far is the same type process will degrade the chlorine off of these structures as well. I don't know what's happened to the organic portion of it, just the carbon back structure on it. But as far as dechlorinating it, we're dechlorinating those as well. So hopefully we'll get some money from this company and do some further studies into it. They sent us some contaminated soil to work with. Also, the dioxin, we started out with an octa-substituted dioxin, and it sequentially takes off the chlorine off of that dioxin all the way down to where you get to the dioxin backbone. So that's pretty exciting as well. The PAHs, that BAP that I showed you, that five-ring structure, we can't take that all apart. That's a real bummer. Because if we had something that was very useful, I would have had a proposal into NSF so fast during the summertime. But all we can do is hydrogenate a few bonds on it. However, what it does is takes it down to a compound that would interrupt the metabolic pathway of creating the toxicity of it. So what happens is as that thing is broken down metabolically by microbes, it creates a very toxic compound in the process. We can interrupt that by changing it and working it into something else. So we have a lot of hope that that's going to go someplace as well. And with that, I would like to thank you guys for your attention. And any more questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Lost canal in New York, the different thing.
Pardon me?
Lost canal in New York. I got the impression out of that once it's put in wood or painted, it's relatively alert. The locals and the people living around the paint structure.
I can explain that, Gary. The question was about Love Canal, and the research at the time, I think that they had shown or were saying that once you paint the surface where the PCBs or other contaminant was, you have essentially sequestered it back in there, and you're going to be safe from it. And where I'm really getting what I'm about to say is from my experience over in Denmark last week in January. They have contamination. What they do is air sampling, determining how many PCBs are coming up into the air, so what you're breathing and what's going quickly into your body. The PCBs were only in the caulk. The PCBs, that's where it was put in. And the caulk has 20% PCBs in it. What happens is, as dust particles, because you know, just, I mean, everybody's house, I don't care how clean you are, let the sun shine through a window and look real closely, you'll see dust particles, right? Those dust particles are landing on that caulk. As they're landing on the caulk and interacting with it, they're picking up PCBs. The dust particles go back into the air. They're landing on the paint. The paint starts picking up PCBs. So they're painted walls. These are in apartments over there. Painted walls are 300 to 600 milligrams per kilogram PCB. The ceiling, 300 to 600, and they never had PCBs in the paint. But it is poured back up into the paint, and as years go by, every 5 years or so, these apartments get repainted. Do you think they go through and clean those walls real good before they paint them? No. So the walls have dust on them that are laden with PCBs. It over it. Even if it has non-PCB paint going over it, you're creating lasagna of PCBs in that structure. So what they found from the caulk, and this is the same thing that's happening up in New York, is they found that even if the PCBs are not in the paint to begin with, the PCBs are migrating from particulates and dust in the sort. And they also migrate from that caulk into the material next to it. And so they're migrating into the concrete, into the wood that are next to the caulk. If you take out the caulk, which would be the logical thing to do, so purify out the caulk, put new caulk in, what happens is you start getting that equilibrium going on, you start contaminating the caulk from the concrete that is around. So it's kind of a no-win situation, and most people don't want their kids in a school where they know that there's a PCB concentration in the air. So very definitely just painting over it is not the answer to it if you're trying to control it.
Milligrams per kilogram is actually that is the lethal dose. Carcinogen is the most.
The dose depends on which congener that you're inhaling. And what is the toxic dose for PCBs? And it depends on which congener you're inhaling. Some congeners, they don't have real good evidence that they're terribly toxic. Other congeners, they call them dioxin-like congeners, that where those two rings are more aligned, are much more toxic. So the dose for those is going to be relatively low. So. And I don't know what, I can tell you what the regulatory levels are. The regulatory levels, if they go and test this team right here, and it's below 50 milligrams per kilogram, they'll say, okay, you got to get rid of it, but you can get rid of it in, I guess, a RCRA landfill. So a hazardous waste landfill, but not the highest level hazardous waste landfill, because you still have to get rid of it. If you have that paint in 51 milligrams per kilogram, it now goes into a TSCA level remediation project. And you have to remediate the structure down to 2 parts per million or less. And EPA, at this time, this is one of our challenges, EPA at the time is batting this back around like a ping pong ball on where the level has got to get down to. How, what is remediation? When you take it down to lower level, how low does it go? And believe it or not, EPA is not, they are not clear on that, especially from one region to another. There is nothing out there right now that they can do with concrete other than cut it away. So you can imagine with a lot of structures like that unnamed historical school in Boston area, they don't want to start cutting away large portions of their structures that they can avoid. Yeah.
Where?
Oh, I'm sorry. It can be. It depends on the concentration you start with. you get this material onto the surface that you're treating. It draws, two things are happening. It's got to open up that structure and draw the PCBs out, and then the metal particles inside have to degrade the PCBs. And one of our challenges is that we're fighting time on that, because the metal particles are at their best activity early on, but it's going to take you some time, days, to really draw the mass out of that paint. And depending, and I can tell you, paint is not the same. From one paint to another paint to another paint, they're all very different, and they have to be tested really first. But it takes a certain amount of time to get that out, and then your particle's reacting. So that's why when I was talking to this lady up here about what I think is really the logical thing to do with this, don't even put metal in the material before you apply it. Apply the paste, give it enough time to draw the PCBs out, throw it into a 55-gallon drum, then add your metal, some more solvent, a little bit of acid, cap the drum, make an exhaust on it, and let it sit. And then it can degrade in that drum. So there are competing processes on it. If it's low enough concentration, it can degrade it in a few weeks on the wall. Okay, so degradation does happen. But if you really need a lot of activity, you have to have that pumped up. Yes. That what they were doing, last I heard, was pump and treat, where they forever, and they will have that there forever. Now they can stop, and it will look, or sample it, and it's going to look clean. They can get down to remediation levels and say, oh, we're clean. But if they stop it, the water, if you think about what happens with pumping, you're drawing water in. So theoretically, you're actually drawing clean water over your contaminated zone, diluting it and drawing it back up. You're drawing your contaminated water out of there. This stuff is not, TCE is not incredibly water soluble. So I think it's 1,100 parts per million at 25 degrees or 15 degrees, something like that, which isn't that soluble. This stuff will sit in a bubble at the bottom of a beaker of water for a long time. So when they're drawing that through, the water's coming out faster than it can resolubilize. So they're starting to see clean come up. They stop the pumping, turn the pumping off, and then the water sits there for a while longer. And then the concentration starts to rise and rise and rise because you have smeared TCE on soil particles. You have crevices, you have gas, you have all these other forms of TCE or perchloroethylene, I think it was in that case, that is down there sorbed to the soil. And over time, it starts coming back into the water. So then they have to start pumping again. And the issue with pump and treat isn't just the capital cost at the beginning. It's manning those things. And I listened to a lot, actually, of talks at conferences on this. And at any one time, at least 20% of their pumps will be down. So you have to have somebody managing this all the time to make sure that your pumps are still going. Man hours is the biggest cost. What we do, that stuff that we do, is really more designed to focus, though, on the highest concentration areas. It's not cheap, but relative to other things, it's not expensive either, relative to other cleanup methods. Yes, pretty hard to do. Pretty hard to do. But you can pump this stuff down 100 feet into the area where it is. So what we do is generally, we said, if it's over 300 parts per million, find your areas where it's really, really hot like that, really, really high concentration. You can use this. It'll knock out up to 100% of it. I shouldn't say 100%. Up to 90% of it within a month. It'll degrade it. And then if you have the large mass gone, then you can keep treating those low concentration areas. around it. But yeah, a lot of companies. Another one is a that had a problem with a large entertainment park on the other side of Orlando, who told us when we talked to them, we don't want to be known for finding toxic chemicals. We want to be known for finding Nemo. So, I mean, they had a big problem out there, and they were trying to do it as inconspicuously as possible, and they didn't want to try anything new. So I did something true out there as well.
Just a couple of questions. It shows that in the bio, the TV actually alerts lower than the time itself. So how heavy exactly is
it? It's got a density, I believe, of 1.44 grams per milliliter, and water's one. So it sinks down to the bottom. Now, iron particles, small iron particles, in mass, I mean, if you could have them all, if you talk about the density of iron, you're talking about the density of iron as like a cube of iron. So I can't really tell you the density of nanoparticles poured into that kind of system, but I can tell you that they are not drawn. The nanoparticle itself, as soon as it gets down in that water, it's surrounded by water. So it takes on its own kind of charge layer around it, and it is not drawn down into that organic hydrophobic material more or less, yeah. PCE will last till your children's grandchildren are dead. They have no microbial action going on. It's not exposed to the sun. It will degrade a little faster when it's got light coming in to it. But otherwise, it sticks around. And that was one of the things that you didn't know when they were using it and it's off and out into the environment.
I think
I love your question. I love your question. You asked about the Hudson River, where GE is responsible for the contamination of the sediments in the Hudson River. And I was just at a sediments conference in New Orleans 2 weeks ago and listening to a lot of presentations on what they're doing with that, by the way. GE was really hesitant about trying anything with this, and to be fair to them, as far as treating sediments, we're still in the early stages of it. We found some very promising techniques with it, but treating a sediment at the bottom of the river is a difficult thing to do for many reasons. One is you don't want to stir it up. And anybody who's walked down into a body of water barefooted knows how the sediment or sand at the bottom of a body of water stirs up just when you walk through it. So you can imagine if you've got contaminated sediments down there, what's happening when you stir that up, it goes back up into the water column and makes it very much more bioavailable than if you can just leave it down there at the bottom. So for us to use it, we would have to apply some kind of cap over the sediment and pump underneath it. What I've seen so far in our laboratory is you get pretty good remediation of the acid sediment that somebody else sent us from another contaminated site in Northview. And we've treated those sediments with various quantities of water. But really practically, what I would foresee for this technology so far is having it dug up over on the side, treated on the side. Deal with it there instead of sending it to a hazardous landfill. And what I saw at these conferences were a lot of presentations on the work that they've done out there. We've been doing dredging. And they do see a significant amount of PCBs move down the river as they're doing this. So they take samples at like a mile, they take samples at 5 miles, they take samples further down than that. And what they see is high PCBs like a mile down, it reduces 5 miles down, it reduces more further down the river, which means it's coming back out. So they're moving harder. what they're not digging up, they're moving a lot of it down the river to other places, so places that may not have been contaminated or more contaminated. But they're already moving.
I see.
I'm staying away from this
one.
Because I think it's been tested to death. And I think for the quantity, the question was, would I drink water out of a plastic bottle? And the answer is yes. Would I take my child's baby bottle, fill it with an acidic concoction, put it in the microwave, and heat it up for 2 hours, and then pull it out, let it cool down, feed it to my baby? No.
Now, far that the water drop in the water maybe, to kill bacteria, and then it's
I don't know if they, do they do that? I mean, I don't know how much they do that. We're Nestle in our free water of North Florida, are they chlorinating it before they put it in bottles? Chlorine, or are they ozonated?
Well, ozonated water is also a reaction. Also, they thought they would set a chloride and set a chlorine and a lot of the they use other things at the same time and they put it out of the that's just a problem with my mind.
I think that none of this is really, if it's filling the flow, got to think about what it might be. And that's not necessarily meaning that we have the same functions, because sometimes, of course, we don't. But I don't want to handle any of this stuff with my bare skin. Am I afraid to walk out into the yard after, you know, to meet and feed? Not really. You know, so there's a level. You're around it all the time. Not more than once a week. Yes.
If it causes a station, stay home.
The water by house is called water, and reusing drinking water from the bottled water.
I think that it depends on how you clean the bottle. And also, like with the tribetal methane, or the mineral methane that are in there, if you leave it open for a while, it's going to exhaust. These things are very volatile. They don't want to stay in water. Yeah, they don't want to stay in water. But the flip side of that is then, you know, leaving it, you know, so it, you know, there's a little bit of danger in all of us, but to live a modern life, and people, you know, a lot of people ask you about, well, in Europe they ozonate water, they don't chlorinate water. Well, you're living pretty much closer to where your water plant is, then, you know, maybe that's more okay. But we're very spread out here in our country, so it's not that the ozone doesn't degrade or kill off the microbes. Well, it does. Really good job, but it's enticing it to you that requires the chlorine in it. And if you've ever seen a cutout of those pipes, you get drip. I don't drink out of a drinking fountain without pushing down the button and holding it for 30 seconds. And that may or may not be getting rid of it, but it's my routine. And I just hold it and make sure that it's kind of flowed out. I want to get the middle of that water coming through, not what's right in equal.
Celebrating with the edges of it.
Beforehand, I'll send out an email announcement. If you are not on our announcement list and you would like to be, CV, Before Ed left a moment ago, he gave me some bumper stickers to pass out.
Oh, good!
So if you're interested, you might get one of these also. Our next topic, first Wednesday, I don't know the date, but first Wednesday of next month, will be on the subject of climate change. It's a new kind of sort of a synthesis of several disciplines. Pete Dunkelberg here is going to tell us all about how math and physics and climatology can help us all understand what goes into making climate change and give us an idea of how we can think about it better. And, so I'll see you next month. Thank you for coming.
You guys need to take these and put them on your car so everybody recognizes that science is important.
April 6th. Thank
you. You got a copy?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I've got it on my stick.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to give it to him.
It'll be on our website.
This also helps you find your car in the parking lot.
Are you selling these?
Free.
Free.
Okay. Thank you. I need the second part there. Pete's red, which is
soft. Yeah.
Second part.
That's a fly.
Oh my gosh, he's frightening, isn't he?
Nice job, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Janet, you did magnifique.
Oh, really? Thank you.
I'll make sure I keep getting fired back.
Next month, you're allowed.
Can they grab one of these?
Some days I'm kind of wondering if something like that.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.